Gary. We will go next to WebEx. Justice Miller-Lerman.
Good morning, Justice Miller-Lerman, appearing by WebEx. Thank you.
William Castle.
Stephanie Stacy.
Jeff Fonk, appearing by WebEx.
Jonathan Havoc.
John Freidenberg.
And with that, Mr. Pivovar, you may approach and you may proceed. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Greg Pivovar. I'm appearing on behalf of the defendant as an adjunct to the Sarpy County Public Defender's Office today. In this particular case, the defendant was found dead on November 17th, 2017. The case, as it developed, indicated that she probably had died or may have died as early as November 8th. That was established in phone records and lack thereof afterwards, I guess, because the coroner, the autopsy couldn't really determine how long she had been dead. They said she'd been dead somewhere between a few days to up to 10 days probably. She was killed by multiple blows to the head and two projectiles. Those projectiles not being bullets, but instead being perhaps pellets from a pellet gun. She lived with the defendant in a trailer, a mobile home in Bellevue. They still lived together at that time. There had been some estrangement over the last year because he remained an alcoholic and she was an alcoholic seeking treatment. There was a lot of blood evidence in the area. They arrested the defendant on the 17th in the parking lot of Baker's, driving the victim's truck and having some credit cards of the defendant. There was minor blood evidence on him, tested only one spot on his pants and one spot on his shoes, and they were positive for her blood. The defendant was tested for insanity. He was obviously a terrible alcoholic during that interview by Dr. Terry Davis. Dr. Davis, who had done over 500 insanity evaluations, and had only found less than 10 people ever to be insane. And he said, I'm not even sure it gets close to 10. So a very minuscule amount. Dr. Davis found him to be insane. He found he had a mental disease, which was a neurocognitive disorder. And that at the time of the incident, that if he in fact killed her, that neurocognitive disorder and his use of alcohol would have caused him to not know the difference between right and wrong, and not know what he was doing.
At the time of trial, did the jury hear conflicting expert testimony from both sides?
Which decided by the judge.
I apologize. I misspoke. Did the judge hear conflicting?
Yes. There was an expert called on behalf of the state. They called Dr. Hartman, and he worked in conjunction with Dr. Abel, who did some testing on the defendant too. She did mostly cognitive testing on the defendant, and then Dr. Hartman interviewed and gave his opinion, which was that they didn't think he suffered from the neurocognitive disorder. So the first issue the judge faced when making the decision was whether, first of all, the state had a motion in limine to try to keep the opinion out, they tried to keep the opinion out. They said, you know, we don't think it meets the burden of even getting passed and being decided. The judge said, well, I'm going to let it all in, but I'm going to, you know, I'll weigh the evidence when I get all the evidence.
If in weighing that evidence, the trial judge credited Dr. Hartman and Dr. Abel's testimony, not credit Dr. Davis's testimony, how is that reversible error?
Well, that she was clearly wrong in doing that, I guess.
What's the best argument for why that would be clearly wrong?
Well, I guess the best argument would be that Dr. Abels, in her evaluation, found some of the same things that Dr. Davis found as far as low functioning and some evidence of a neurocognitive disorder, not to the extent that Dr. Davis did. She gave him the TOMS test to see if he was malingering, if he had memory malingering, whether he was faking it in that particular case. And she decided that he did not. He was not, and that his non-memory of the events around the death of the victim was honest in her opinion. She couldn't say that he absolutely had no memory of the incident. I mean, she couldn't go to the truth or falsity of it, but she said there was no evidence that he's faking this non-memory. So I guess the best evidence, in my opinion, would be the fact that there's some support in the plaintiff's experts of some of the things that were found by Dr. Davis. I guess the other thing is, the sheer numbers of times he's done this and the paucity of ever having found anybody insane.
Did Mr. Davis interview the defendant immediately after the homicide or close to it? Time of the homicide?
I believe the time frame, Judge, was he was arrested November 17th. He was interviewed sometime in mid-March. So we're talking about a four-month span there that the defendant was in jail trying, I suppose, to recall what happened. I mean, there's some evidence and phone calls he made to his brother while in jail trying to, where he was at least consistent that he couldn't say what happened. He was never inconsistent in his calls to his brother. He made some statements that could be attributed to having done something. One he made to tell the daughter, I didn't mean it or something, or I'm sorry about the death. And he talked back and forth with his brother trying to jog his memory, I think, at times in some of the phone calls.
About the fact that he fled from the home. Does that indicate that he may have known right from wrong?
Well, Judge, I don't know that the evidence supports he fled the home. My reading of the evidence would be, first of all, the state established, at least as their time of death, November 8th. They have him on the computer on November 9th in the home. Okay? He's researching suicide by numerous options, taking acetaminophen, pellet gun to the head, natural gas. So there's no evidence that he fled the home. Nobody testified at trial. None of the neighbors testified that they didn't see him around. None testified that they saw him around, but none were really called either. He was found in the victim's truck. He had used one of the credit cards 3 days before he was found at Baker's. The receipt showed the purchase of half and half, God knows why, but half and half. And the evidence at the crime scene showed empty containers are half and half. So I think that goes to show that he was still coming back and forth to the residence. I'm not sure that there's ever been established that he spent that whole time sleeping in that truck or anything of that nature. So I don't think there was evidence of flight to go to guilt in this particular case. I mean, I think it's just as likely that he was coming back and forth because there's also blood tracked down the, she was killed in the main area of the mobile home, and there was blood going down the hallway, okay? Indicative of staying sometime. It could have happened that night, but it also could have happened 8 days later where he kept stepping over a dead body and getting blood on his shoes. And only a few spots were tested. There was, the police testified that they thought there were more spots that were blood, but only the one on his shoes and the one on his pants was tested. They also thought there was blood on his hands when he was arrested. They put grocery sacks over his hands right away so as to not disturb what looked to be blood on his hands. That ended up not being blood. It was tested and it was not blood.
Of what significance, if any, are the researcher topics that were found on his web browser to the effect of, can you kill yourself with a pellet gun? Or are socks and underwear provided in prison? Did that material come in? And if so, what does it mean?
It did, as well as other material, Judge, that I was mentioning before, that it was not just whether you can kill yourself with a pellet gun, it's whether you can kill yourself in a numerous variety of ways. I suppose some of that is indicative that perhaps, well, being insane at the time of the actual incident, if it occurred, if he did it, that he still at the residence looking at this dead body and thinking he must have done something. I must have done it, but I don't remember. And he then decides that maybe suicide's his best way. It wasn't just a pellet gun to the head. It was numerous ways of suicide that he was researching. As far as this, again, Well, being insane at the time of the incident, if he did it, he's realizing that he may end up in jail. So what do I get when I go to jail?
Doesn't that suggest that that he did understand the difference between right and wrong?
Not at the time of the incident would be my argument. It would to me be indicative that Dr. Davis testified that in order for him to be insane, he would have had to have the 0.20 at least, okay, in addition to his neurocognitive
disorder. In order to have a blackout.
In an amniotic blackout. So that was his testimony. So I guess what's indicative is we don't know the exact time of death. We don't know when he temporarily sobered up, because his memory was he was drinking 24 cans of beer and other alcohol per day. But at some point, he may have sobered up enough to realize that something happened, and he may be on the hook for it, even though he doesn't remember. So the insanity only has to last for a short period of time. It doesn't have to last forever. He didn't search the web until late. Well, I think it was into the night, in the early morning hours of the night, is when he started.
If he didn't, if your argument is he didn't know right and wrong at the time of the incident, and then later is that a temporary condition that's proximately caused by the voluntary ingestion of alcohol? And if it is, how do you get around 29, 22, 03, 04?
I disagree. I think his ingestion of alcohol wasn't temporary. It was every day. He testified that he remembers for about the last month he was drinking 24 cans of beer a day. I don't think the ingestion of alcohol just enhances the neurocognitive disorder. It's not the cause in this particular case.
So wasn't it Dr. Davis's testimony that the problem here is he has the neurocognitive disorder, but when there's a certain blood alcohol content, that triggers the blackouts, which leads to the inability to tell right from wrong. Is that an unfair characterization?
I think Dr. Davis's testimony at times was confusing in that regard, and it confused me. It may be a fair characterization. Again, we're getting into the argument that never works here, but this was just as likely a result of a sudden quarrel as it was second degree murder, in my opinion. I know, again, we're going to get into the argument I can't win, but his memory did serve him to say that they'd been fighting over the period of months. So there was a damaged relationship here. And, you know, the pellet gun research did not occur until after the incident. He did not, that was not, to my recollection, a research in prior to what the state establishes as the date of death or the time day of death. So I guess it was just as likely that she, in his opinion, said something that resulted in a sudden quarrel.
What evidence was there sufficient provocation to get to a sudden quarrel and manslaughter?
I guess the three blows to the head. His memories contained in the in the insanity evaluations that, and I think he said once in there almost word for word that she must have done something to make me mad, something of that nature in the evaluations. So I guess that to me is equally sudden quarrel manslaughter as it is second degree murder. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Don't forget your mask. Oh.
Okay. Ms. Faust, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Stacey Faust and I'm Assistant Attorney General representing the appellee, the state of Nebraska. Stack assigns four errors. He assigns that the district court erred when it overruled his insanity defense, when it found sufficient evidence to support the verdicts, when it found him guilty of secondary murder rather than sudden quarrel manslaughter, and when it opposed an excessive sentence. I'm going to focus this morning on the first two regarding insanity and sufficiency. Probably briefly address the third, otherwise I will submit the excessive sentence on the brief. As I stated in brief, I understand Stack to be arguing that he was legally insane at the time of defense because his insanity was not brought on solely by voluntary intoxication, but rather it was in combination with his diagnosis of a mental disease or defect. The solely language comes from this court's opinion of State versus Hotz. This court found that in Hotz that a defendant may not assert an insanity defense when the insanity was temporary and brought on solely by voluntary intoxication. And later in State versus Bigelow, this court stated that without evidence linking intoxication to a mental disease or defect or disorder, there is no evidence to support an insanity defense. So as I understand it, Sack's argument is, well, he does have a mental disease or defect. To support the insanity defense, he has to show by a preponderance of the evidence that he had a mental disease or defect and that he did not know or understand the nature and consequences of his actions. He failed both. He was not insane. There are three experts in this case. The defense expert, Dr. Davis, testified that the mental disease or defect that Stack suffers from is alcohol-induced mild neurocognitive disorder. Basically, according to Dr. Davis, Stack's chronic drinking caused him to have immediate and short-term memory impairment. On the other hand, the state's experts, Dr. Hartman and Dr. Abel, testified that their testing and their examination, namely the fact that Stack could remember events both leading up to and after Diane's death, but conveniently not at the time of her death, revealed that Stack did not suffer from a mild neurocognitive disorder. Here we have competing experts, and this court does not resolve conflicts of the evidence in the evidence or pass on the credibility of witnesses. Based on Dr. Hartman and Dr. Abel's testimony, Stack's arguments that he had a mental disease or defect at the time of the crime fails, and as a result, any insanity defense. But even if we accept Dr. Davis's testimony that Stack has an alcohol-induced mild neurocognitive disorder, Dr. Davis did not testify that is what caused Stack to be unable to know or understand the nature and consequences of his actions. And this gets to Justice Papik's question. Dr. Davis testified that Stack's inability was due to an alcoholic blackout. And the blackout was caused not by his disorder, but by his disorder plus his voluntary intoxication. That blackout was a temporary condition, and under Statute 29-2203, subsection 4, insanity does not include a temporary condition that was proximately caused by voluntary intoxication. Thus, even under his own expert's testimony, Stack failed on the second prong of the insanity defense. It should also be noted that Dr. Hartman testified that individuals who suffer alcoholic blackouts do know and understand the consequences of their actions. For those reasons, Stack's assigned error regarding insanity is without merit. In his brief, Stack argues that this court should adopt something termed equipoise rule, and it's really just a variation in my mind of the accused rule that this court has rejected time and time again. I'd like to go over a few of the some of the evidence that shows that the statement is burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt that Stack did commit secondary murder and use of a deadly weapon. As this court went through some of the evidence with opposing counsel, Stack lived with Diane and he continued to live there for several days with her deceased body lying in the living room. By his own jail statements to his brother, he became intoxicated leading up to the time of her death to deal with his built up anger and irritation towards her. Her blood was found on his pants and shoe, and while it was a limited amount, the pathologist did testify that the other spots did look like blood as well. This testing costs money. She's not going to test every single spot on every piece of evidence unless requested to do so.
Was there ever a request by defendant to test any more materials?
No. Her blood was also found on his pellet gun. She had multiple blunt force injuries consistent with the gun, and a pellet was found behind her right eye. Stack has brown hair, and brown hair was found in her hand. Officers found Stack in her truck with her cell phone. Her cell phone also had blood on it, and he did have the bank cards for her, but also for her mom. November 8th was the last date that an outgoing message was sent from Diane's phone and her Facebook account. On that same day, while Stack did conduct searches for suicide, he also conducted searches on his computer for whether a 0.177 caliber bullet can penetrate a human skull, which is that's how she died. The searches stopped until November 10th, when he searched for decomposition of a human body timeline, and a day later for what gets supplied for you in jail or prison. And because of that evidence, the statement is burden of proof, the correct burden of proof, which is that any rational trier fact could have found the essential elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt.
Can you tell us a little bit about the accused rule and what jurisdictions, if any, have adopted it? And are we in the majority, the minority? Where are we?
As for the accused rule, I'm not sure if we're in the majority or minority, because as counsel conceded, this court has rejected that time and time again. He was looking for good law to support adoption of it. The equipoise rule, I don't think there is really not much of a distinction. It's worded a little bit differently. The equipoise rule is what is adopted by a couple of federal courts. I don't think that there is a clear majority or minority. As I pointed in my brief, the counsel points to the Second Circuit case that while the Second Circuit brought it from the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit has since rejected it. The Eighth Circuit has been inconsistent in its application of the equipoise rule. And I personally don't believe the equipoise rule is the correct standard, because it really does what the accused rule allows, which is to give the accused the benefit of the inferences and to make the prosecution have to disprove every hypothesis of non-guilt in order to convict. And it really is a reassessment of the evidence by an appellate court, which an appellate court is not supposed to do. And it is, I think, invading into the territory of the trier of fact, which again, we're supposed to give deference to those findings by the trier of fact.
Is the accused rule limited to those cases in which an insanity defense has been presented?
In the cases that I saw, that I researched, I don't think any of them were insanity defense. It was just purely a sufficiency of the evidence argument.
Thank you.
turn to the manslaughter issue. How does the state propose that trier of fact is to navigate the decision between second-degree murder and manslaughter?
Well, I suppose, just like a jury would, the only difference is the absence or presence of sudden quarrel or sudden quarrel provocation. So looking at the evidence, was there evidence of sudden quarrel provocation, at which point it should reduce the charge down from second-degree murder to sudden quarrel manslaughter. In this case, there's absolutely no evidence that Diane did or said anything to have provoked a reasonable person in Stack's position to repeatedly strike and twice shoot her in the head with a pellet gun. The only thing that we know is that he thought Diane was evil and mean to him, and he did not want to listen to her mouth anymore. So he got drunk to calm his irritation at her, and he stayed drunk. And none of that evidence is evidence of sudden quarrel provocation on Diane's part.
Is this correct that his hair was found in her hand? Is that correct?
Yes. Opposing counsel in his brief says he doesn't have brown hair, but if you look at the photographs, the exhibits, the photographs from when he was admitted to the emergency room after his arrest for chest complaints, he doesn't have his hat on anymore, and he does have brown hair.
I see. So what's the significance of the, if I've got this right, his hair in her hand, is that because of her defensive activity, or could it be evidence of a prior altercation?
I think that the trier of fact would absolutely be free to take that as defensive activity. And that's what the trial harvest did, because she found him guilty of second-degree murder.
Did Mr. Stack have any injuries that there were noticeable upon him?
I don't remember. Nothing obviously that struck me. He might have some scratches. I don't believe so though. There are no further questions. We ask you from the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? That concludes arguments on this case. And Mr. Pivovar, were you appointed in this matter?
The public defender's office will let's stay hired.
We thank you for your service, and please exit through the side door here, if you would, and social distance, if at all possible. Again, thank you very much for participating for us today.
Thank you, Brian.